The art of storytelling is enjoying a resurgence, but being a writer is paying less and less.
How do you stay afloat in this economy? It's a tough time. It's a really tough time.
A writer's festival and the writing life in a recession. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. We love a good story. It probably began when our ancestors sat around a fire and told stories to pass the long, lonely nights. Myths and fairy tales offer lessons as well as stories of things that never were. Audiobooks let us immerse ourselves in a tale, and the wonders of technology now let us edit our work so easily that more and more people are drawn to writing their own stories. A search of literarytourist.com reveals dozens of writers' festivals around the world all year long. In the Berkshires of Massachusetts, the month of March is chock full of events for women writers. Susie Banks Baum is kicking off the first night of the Berkshire Festival of Women Writers. She's the editor of an anthology of babes, 36 Women Give Motherhood a Voice.
It's called the Berkshire Festival of Women Writers. It's a Berkshire County-wide festival that this year has 58 events at 36 different venues throughout Berkshire County. And Simon's Rock College of Bard produces it. Dr. Jenny Brody De Hernandez is the festival chairperson. It started a number of years ago as an International Women's Day event. And they did a version of the festival as Women in the Arts, Women in the Sciences, and then this writing festival sort of grabbed hold, and it's been 3 years. And this year, I'm really, you know, honored that I get to be part of it, that my event is the opening night of the festival. There's two daytime events on March 1st, and then my event, Out of the Mouths of Babes, an Evening of Mothers Reading to Others, is the first evening event on March 1st. The festival this year has a theme around health and wellness, and so the title is Writing the Self, Writing the World, New Visions of Personal and Planetary Health and Healing. So 16 of the 58 sessions are really exploring that topic. My event is really geared around motherhood and creativity, and the conversation really, I call it writing from the soul of the mother. So women are not necessarily writing about their children. They're really voicing the sort of combustion that happens inside of a woman as she mothers.
Susie, this is just my impression, and I may be wrong. Perhaps it's just that we communicate so much more easily now that you hear about things and you perceive them as being popular. But my perception is that memoir is huge right now. I live in New York's Catskill region, and we've got the Woodstock Writers Festival that is growing every year. We've got the TMI Project, which has taken off with story collections and performances and workshops in prisons. And then you've got things like the Moth Radio Hour that you can sit back, listen to your radio, and hear someone tell you a story. And I'm wondering, obviously we've always loved stories, but what is the draw for us right now?
Susan, this is a really good question to consider. Like, what is it that draws people in? And as we become, I've listened to a lot of discussion around human contact, like, where do we interact? And if we allow machines to be in between that interaction, we get lost in that sort of little, tiny little soundbite, the 140 characters of your tweet or whatever. But being pulled into a story via the radio or a live event, I think it just answers such an ancient part of us to experience vicariously through images and words. I find it really hopeful. I find story really, an encouraging and hopeful medium, dimmed or stymied.
And writing is one art form that almost anybody can do. Perhaps not all do as well as others, but we can all do it. And yet many people are interested in trying and won't. And what I wondered is, they think it's too hard. And is it, when you have people come to these workshops, Do you encourage them to try to think about their stories in a broader context, to look for that theme that will tie it in to a broader message? Or is it just as simple as saying, tell that story?
That's a good question. I think we really bear toward the latter, tell that story. That was the experience that I had when I first started my writing. Hearing stories from inside motherhood that valued the role of mother, that dealt with the frustrations of being a woman in our culture, there's a lot to be said yet. We haven't exhausted the topic.
That's Susie Banks Baum, the editor of a new book, An Anthology of Babes, 36 Women Give Motherhood a Voice. Find out more about the Berkshire Festival of Women Writers at berkshirewomenwriters.org. A writer who's been a friend of 51% is Sari Botten. Her current book, Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York, remains on the bestseller list at New York's revered Strand Bookstore. She is also co-founder and editorial director of the TMI Project, a Hudson Valley-based nonprofit that offers workshops in memoir and storytelling, as well as performance. We sat down earlier this winter to talk about the dark side of being a writer, the fact that it doesn't pay the bills.
Well, I like being freelance. That's first of all, that's just my nature. I like to have a few balls in the air. But I've had to have more balls in the air than I want because of the economy. I mean, I'm just going to confess, I barely get by, and I do so much work, so much hard work. I have, nearly a two-thirds time job with TMI Project as the editorial director. I've edited two anthologies this year, and I've done a bunch of ghostwriting, too, on top of it. And I'm currently editing someone's book, deeply editing. And with all of that, I'm still, I don't know if I'll ever get in front of the eight ball.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge. And so both of us at the same time are in a financially challenged place, and it's stressful. Very, very stressful. And we've toyed with renting out a part of our house. You know, how do you stay afloat in this economy? It's a tough time. It's a really tough time.
What about healthcare? What do you do with that?
There's that too. We get healthcare through the Freelancers Union, but it is not great. I mean, it's good to have. We still each have a $3,000 deductible for, out of pocket for out of network and hospitalization, and a high prescription deductible. A couple years ago, I taught at SUNY Albany. I was an adjunct. I taught two classes mainly so that I could get really cheap health insurance for us. And it was not only cheap, but it was great. I had a major operation and it cost me $71.
Wow.
Yeah. But I found that my entire paycheck was going into gas and tolls. So, you know, it's no matter how I try to balance it, I'm always behind the eight ball.
Right.
I don't know what it's going to be that's going to take me out from that. And I was also sort of marveling that it's really true that we are the first generation that will have less than our parents. And I can't imagine a day when we'll be able to afford to retire.
Yeah.
Can you?
No.
Yeah. I mean, we're even contemplating liquidating what little IRAs we have if certain things don't work out in the next few months. You know, it's just... And we were feeling like ashamed and scared. And then we talked to some friends and they're in the exact same boat.
Oh, yeah.
We have friends who've already liquidated their IRAs. And, what's the difference between your $12,000 IRA and if it's an $8,000? And we don't have any money in it anyway.
You know? Exactly.
So I don't know. And how do people do it with kids? We don't even have kids. I don't know how people do it today. It's a really, really hard time. And the cost of living keeps going up. And what I do as a writer and editor keeps getting devalued. The money I am offered for ghostwriting projects gets smaller and smaller because more and more journalists are doing it because you can't make any money at journalism anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's this weird thing that's happening. Like, Has that ever happened in history before, where the cost of living goes up but not wages? Don't they usually go hand in hand?
I don't know. It does feel, though, like you're on some sort of a curve, and I don't know whether we're going to plummet or whether things are going to change and improve, but there's this huge shift that's happening, and I don't know where it's going.
It feels like something, unfortunately, it feels like something awful has to happen, and like everything has to break down and start back up again, like some awful storm and nobody can pay their mortgages, so the mortgage companies suffer. And like it's going to take something that will make the people with the money suffer. They're not going to want anything to change until, like, the banks, there are no penalties for the banks because they're too big to fail. So I feel, unfortunately, like something bigger, something that can make them fail needs to come along so that they are at the table with us saying, all right, now what do we do?
Sari Botten is the editor of Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. Coming up, scouting for the digital age. Plus, innovating the Stay in School campaign. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1284. Girl Scouts. It conjures up memories of stiff little uniforms, sashes covered with badges, and a world that seems gone forever. There's a new co-ed version of Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts for the digital age, one where kids get to make up their own rules. It's called DIY.org. Their motto is, get skills, be awesome.
Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts are do-it-yourselfers by nature. The organizations were founded on ideals like self-sufficiency and wilderness survival. These are timeless values, but some families find the 100-year-old scouting institutions to be a little out of touch. They require uniforms, their websites are clunky, and they have a lot of rules. But there's a new kid-driven, co-ed version of scouting for the digital age. It's called DIY.org. Their motto is, get skills, be awesome. And they have badges. They call them patches, but they look a lot like those things my mom sewed onto my Girl Scout sash when I was a kid.
One of my patches, what I'm proud of, is Duct Tape Ninja, making things out of duct tape.
This is Lucy Bowman.
I'm 10, and I like crafting.
Lucy has lots of patches.
Fort Builder, Shelter Builder, Prankster.
To earn a patch, a kid has to complete 3 challenges. Then they upload a picture or video of whatever they made. The DIY.org staff reviews it and doles out the patches.
Cardboarder, printmaker, paper crafter, and toy maker.
Lucy was excited to show me a drawing she did to earn her illustrator patch.
My owl fish bear that I drew. It's a combination, a head of an owl, body of a fish, and legs of a bear.
The site is completely free for parents and kids to use. There are no ads, but there is a market on DIY.org that sells some do-it-yourself kits, backpacks, and the physical patches. They're $5 each. The virtual patches are free. They get displayed on the user's portfolio pages. Like many of the kids on the site, Lucy doesn't use her real name. Instead of a profile picture, she has an avatar.
My avatar, since it's sort of anonymous, I am a raccoon named Skitter Evil.
DIY.org is pretty new. It first went live in the spring of 2012, and they have about 200,000 users. That's according to this guy.
Hi, my name is Zach Klein, and I'm the CEO of DIY.
Zach is one of 3 guys who started DIY.org in San Francisco. He's 31, and he just so happens to be an Eagle Scout himself. One of his other claims to fame is co-founding and designing the video sharing website Vimeo. He doesn't have kids, but in creating DIY.org, he drew inspiration from his own childhood experience.
For example, when I was 11, I was really into making web pages. My parents had just signed up for AOL.
Welcome. You've got mail.
And AOL offered this really cool free tool where you can make a web page easily. And I was living in my own internal world, just making web pages. And there was no one in my life who understood the value of what I was doing. And there's no way they could have anticipated that what I was doing then would someday become a really important skill.
Zach says that's why a lot of the ideas for the skills on DIY.org come from kids who use the site.
we're not really good predictors of what skills will be valuable when these kids are adults.
Magician.
Game designer.
Special effects wizard.
And so we have to treat the things that they're passionate about with the same level of importance and prestige as skills that have been traditionally valuable.
Gardener.
Chemist. Woodworker.
One thing all the kids on the site are learning is how to be social online. Kids can follow each other's portfolios and comment on each other's projects.
This is the first time for a lot of kids that they've had a virtual identity of any kind. And so, yeah, just for the sake of our community being successful, we have to teach kids to be good digital citizens so that their contributions to the community are productive.
There are tools built into DIY.org to help parents monitor the way their kids are using the site. Even though the site is free, parents have to enter credit card information to verify their identity. Like traditional scouting, parental involvement is a key component. The thing that I find really fascinating about DIY.org, and something that separates it from Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, is the way it exists in both the digital and the physical world. Some of the skills are purely digital.
Web designer.
Meme hacker.
Front-end developer.
But a lot of them require kids to step away from the screen and make something with their hands.
Painter.
Chef.
Stitcher.
Bike mechanic.
Then they create a digital record of their creative project and it lives online where they can share it with their virtual friends. And in some cases, kids are also sharing what they're working on in person.
Okay, if you want to put the chairs on either side and on the back. And then...
On a Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon, 7-year-old Mason Jones and his friend Cam Laraway helped Mason's dad set up for the monthly meeting of the PDX DIY Club.
So it looks like we have a ton of awesome projects.
This is Ben Jones, Mason's dad.
In the back there, we have little bits, robot stuff. And then we've got perler beads, right, Mace?
There are about a dozen kids working in pairs or with their parents on projects they brought or just whatever seems interesting to them. Mason and Cam are digging through a bag of plastic craft supplies.
A little one of these?
Yeah.
We don't know what we're making yet.
7-year-old Amelia Johnson brought along both of her parents. She sits on her mom's lap, working with some brightly colored duct tape.
Here, let's fold this over so it doesn't stick to anything.
Okay, now fold it over on the back.
Oh, this is a wallet, actually, Mom. We just made a wallet. Yeah, cool!
Clubs were not part of the original plan for DIY.org. But since they started popping up, the site has fully embraced the idea. There are 75 clubs listed on DIY.org, and a dozen of those are outside the U.S. Co-founder Zach Klein says there are more out there that are just not registered yet.
It's one thing to build something and get people to visit your website, but it's another thing to actually cause people to meet in the real world and to cause people to spend their Saturdays together doing something creative. It's a profound feeling, and I think it's probably started with families who maybe had dabbled with scouting, you know, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, but wanted to change, and they saw DIY, and they saw that we had patches, and they saw that maybe the skills that we were promoting were more contemporary than those organizations.
Maker.
Rocketeer. Geneticist.
And they just started meeting and working together.
That's actually exactly how Ben Jones and his son discovered DIY. Unlike the more established scouting organizations, DIY.org encourages users to make up their own rules.
Human beings have a superpower, and it's called play. And I guess our theory is just that we want to give kids the tools and the power and the responsibility to go further with their play and to make them feel special and important for doing it.
I'm Julie Sabatier.
Find out more just where the name says to go, DIY.org. And finally, I like to feature creative solutions to social problems. This one comes from Toledo. Like all of Ohio's major cities, high school dropouts are a tough problem for Toledo. One of the reasons students say they leave is because a traditional school setting just isn't a good fit for them. A Toledo Community College program is offering an alternative and challenging option. Place high school dropouts in college classrooms. State Impact's Amy Hansen reports.
Owens Community College staff member Michelle Atkinson frequently hands out a list of rules she advises her students to live by. They're printed on brightly colored laminated sheets with Michelle's 11 commandments written in bold letters across the top.
Never miss class, pay attention in class, pretend like you are interested even when you're not.
Atkinson is an advisor for the Owens chapter of Gateway to College, a national program that offers high school dropouts or students at risk of dropping out a second chance to finish their education by taking college classes. She says the program offers students an alternative when traditional schools just won't click for a variety of reasons.
They might have been having trouble socially in school. They might have been not challenged enough. So putting them into a college environment might actually put them into a little bit more independence where they have to rise and meet the academic endeavors that they need to in order to succeed.
Students begin their gateway education with what's called a foundation term, where they take classes in reading, writing, math, and college skills. After that, once their high school requirements are met, students can begin to earn additional college credits towards a degree. Gateway Director James Jackson says it's a novel approach to helping kids at risk finish school. Rather than try to coerce them back to their public high school or steer them to alternatives like online charter schools.
Basically, we're taking students who were not successful in high school and putting them in college and expecting them to be successful.
Jackson says not everyone's a good fit, and not everyone who applies gets in. First, there are basic eligibility requirements. They must read at a minimum at the ninth grade level, they must have at least 5 high school credits under their belts, and they must be a Toledo resident between the ages of 16 and 21. Then there's a lengthy application process made up of placement testing, transcript reviews, and an in-person interview. That's where Jackson intensely listens for one indicator of success: how students talk about themselves.
Are they the victim in all of their stories? Are they the hero in all of their stories? Or do they have that balance that most of us have? And what I found is that, you know, some students have terrible home lives, background situations. We're talking abusive families, extreme poverty, you know, those kind of things. But despite all of those odds against them, they still believe that they're worth getting, you know, their high school education.
The Gateway program is funded through a few sources: a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, support from Owens, and a little more than $5,000 of state funding for each student from Toledo Public Schools. The program is partnered with the district and is free to students. The college and district coordinate which Owens classes are equivalent to traditional Toledo courses. 18-year-old Matthew Tamarine liked the sound of the program when he joined 2 years ago. Before that, he says, he had failed out of traditional high school, enrolled in an online charter school, and eventually dropped out altogether.
I don't know what made me start to dislike school so much. I mean, I knew it was important, but I just wasn't willing to set school as a priority.
Now Tamarine says he's on a good path to graduate by 2016, thanks in part to earning the best grades of his life last semester, a 3.0 GPA. He attributes his newfound success to the tools Gateway students get to help them manage their classwork, like tutoring sessions and regular meeting with peer mentors. They also get bus passes, a daily free lunch, and near constant access to staff members. But even with those perks, the program still loses some students each year. Last fall semester ended with 54 students. Only a little over 40 returned for the spring. But a record 6 are set to graduate this year. That's gratifying to advisor Michelle Atkinson and keeps her reciting those commandments every chance she gets.
I think sometimes those students just need to be challenged and put into the spot where they're maybe supposed to be meant to be.
For State Impact Ohio, I'm Amy Hansen.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.